From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau on the campus of Tech de Monterrey. And Robin, we are also currently live streaming the show today on Concepto Radial here at the university's campus radio station. We are at the southern end of Mexico City, which is absolutely enormous. More than 20 million people live in the metro area. We have spent a lot of time sitting in traffic, but we have also met a lot of interesting people, and we're going to be hearing from them today and tomorrow.
Well, we cannot wait. But meanwhile, Jeremy, here in the States, tax reform is on the agenda. This morning, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin previewed President Trump's tax cut plan.
We have a very uncompetitive system that's hindering the economy and jobs. We want to make business competitive. And we want to simplify the personal tax system, lower taxes, and create economic growth. So this is going to be the biggest tax cut and the largest tax reform in the history of our country.
Now, Trump's plan is said to be a work in progress. You'll be hearing about it all day on NPR. But joining us now, NPR's economic correspondent, John Itzte. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. So start with Mnuchin's claim. For instance, we know the proposal is to cut corporate taxes, the corporate tax rate, from 35 to 15%. If that and other suggestions do go through, and that's a big question, if they'll go through Congress, would it be the biggest tax cut and tax reform in U.S. history?
Oh, we don't know the total cost until it's scored by the Congressional Budget Office, and that hasn't been done. But if it's passed, it would be very big, both in terms of actual dollars and in terms of share of GDP. I think its only competition might be the first Reagan tax cut of 1981 that later actually got scaled back.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's take corporate cuts, and I'm going to try this, see how I do here. We know the plan would be to cut the rate of traditional corporations. They pay corporate income tax, and then if the owners or the shareholders sell stock, for instance, they pay individual taxes again. But it would also cut the rates of businesses called pass-throughs. Now, they don't pay corporate tax because they pass the profits right through to the owners, who are taxed at an individual tax rate. Their rates would be lowered as well, from 35 to 15. How big a change would this be, and how would this affect President Trump and his businesses?
Well, it could be a huge change for small businesses, single proprietors, partnerships, those sorts of things. As you say, they now pay using the individual tax tables, so a 39% plus top rate. Mm-hmm. Under the Trump proposal, they would pay 15%, a huge cut. And also, you know, you and I might decide we're really one-person businesses and become a contractor with NPR, so we could pay the 15% on our income. The Trump people have said they'd try to limit things like that happening. We'll see.
And I should just say, John Itzte is not recommending that people run out, but that's what could happen.
It could happen.
Yeah.
And you're right. This could save tens of billions or millions of dollars in tax payments for the Trump family businesses, something that I'm sure will raise questions.
Okay. What about personal tax rates? We understand the standard deductions would increase. Tell us more.
Standards of deductions would nearly double or more than double from 15% for individuals to 30% for families. And as I said, more than double what they are now. But if you take the standard deduction, that higher standard deduction, you can't itemize your other deductions. For instance, your interest on your mortgage. Hmm. The Tax Policy Center has estimated the number of people taking the standard deduction, if it were increased this much, would rise dramatically. And that makes the real estate industry worry that mm-hmm. the incentive to buy a home might decline because it would be less attractive to borrow money on a mortgage so you could deduct the interest costs. And this could be a big political hurdle.
Yeah. Okay. So all these cuts mean less money coming into the government. And there's a way that's been suggested to pay for all the cuts, but it's apparently not included in the plan, and that's House Speaker Paul Ryan's border adjustment tax. This would tax imports coming into the country, not exports, product going out. And we know there's already ad campaigns from small businesses saying, wait a second, it's that cocoa that I get that I can't get here that comes in that helps me run my small business. If I'm taxed on that import, I can't do it. So talk about the complications in paying, you know, how to offset these cuts.
Well, the administration argues that tax cuts will juice the economy so much that there'll be more tax revenue because both businesses and people will be making more money. Tax history shows that's not the case. And this gets us to the congressional plan, which actually could pay for a lot of tax cutting with his border adjustment tax, which is mm-hmm. estimated would raise $1 trillion. But Secretary Mnuchin said today that the border adjustment tax doesn't work in its current form. So we'll see. I think there's going to be a big battle between the White House and the Congress on this.
We will keep an eye on it all. John Itzty, NPR economics correspondent. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Well, we're in Mexico City today, where we're taking a closer look at the U.S.-Mexico relationship. And one of the great parts of this remote broadcast is that we're broadcasting from a university, the Tech de Monterrey. This is where KJZZ's Fronteras desk has its Mexico City bureau. And some of the journalism students here have traveled to Arizona to learn about our public radio system in the United States. We've been taking students with us as well on our reporting here in Mexico, and they've been great translators for us. So Rocio Munoz Ledo and Juan Carlos Rios, thank you so much for your great help. Well, one of the things you hear a lot about here is corruption. Why hasn't the government fixed this problem? Because it's corrupt, people will tell you. Earlier this month, two former state governors were arrested outside the country and returned to Mexico on charges that include participating in organized crime and money laundering. Corruption is so common in Mexico that politicians have become punchlines for comedians and inspiration for popular songs. And now you can even take a corruption bus tour. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Mexico City, Jorge Valencia reports.
The tour guide is holding up a microphone and chatting up the crowd. His name is Oscar Rivas. He says the first stop isn't actually on the tour. It's far away, in a very exclusive part of Mexico City. The official corruption tour recording explains the rest. First stop,
esa casa es famosa,
is a famous house.
Ahora se le conoce como la iglesia del perdón.
But now it's known as the Church of Forgiveness. It has marble floors, gardens, underground parking, and Mexico's first lady reportedly bought it from a builder who happened to be a longtime government contractor, which generated widespread speculation about whether the house had actually been a gift.
Voy a trabajar duro para tener una así.
I'm going to work really hard to buy one just like it. That's the joke from the corruption tour recording. As the nickname for the house suggests, President Enrique Peña Nieto asked voters for forgiveness because of the negative attention the Church of Forgiveness drew, a federal investigation that the president commissioned cleared him of any wrongdoing. Now the tour guide says the second stop. This one is a tall federal monument completed in 2012 to celebrate Mexico's bicentennial. It came in past its deadline and over budget. The next stops similarly follow well-publicized cases of alleged favoritism or impunity.
Cuarta parada, OHL. Quinta parada, Antimonumento. Sexta parada, Secretaría de Gobernación.
A construction company, a monument, a government office. Then Rivas, our tour guide, flips the script. He asks whether anyone on the bus has actively participated in government corruption. The hands shoot up, tourists start confessing. A man sitting in the back row named Cirino says he and some friends were drinking alcohol in public when a police officer approached them. They offered the cop some money, the cop took it. And they kept on drinking as if nothing happened. A woman sitting in the middle says she paid off traffic police so she wouldn't get a ticket. And a woman in the front says she paid an officer so he wouldn't tow her car. After the ninth stop, I wanted to know, why did these passengers go on a corruption tour if some of the stops were well known and they themselves had perpetrated corruption?
Y es una experiencia bonita, o sea, al final te das cuenta de, o sea, ya estando en grupo, todos somos parte.
Alicia Mesa, a 28-year-old from Mexico City, says the tour helped her realize corruption is a collective problem.
Ves impactos ya más grandes, ¿no? Hablando de mil millones de pesos o de dólares, pero te das cuenta que el problema empieza en ti.
You realize the problem begins at the individual level, she says. If we don't change ourselves, we can't complain about the people in charge. And the tour guide, Rivas, says the tour is important because people get to make the connection between corruption that's in the public eye and corruption that's in their own lives.
Y te das cuenta que a los mexicanos no nos gusta la corrupción.
The takeaway for him, Mexicans don't like corruption and they want it to stop. At all levels. For Here and Now, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
I'm Jeremy Hobson in Mexico City today, and we're hearing a lot this week from President Trump about the border wall, which he wants Mexico to pay for, although it appears he won't get the funding he wants from Congress for the wall in this week's bill to keep the government running. The president says the U.S. needs a wall to stop the drugs and to stop people from coming into the U.S. illegally. Well, right now, we're going to hear the stories of two friends who have been on the other side of the law when it comes to immigration. We've agreed not to use their last names. We met Eddie and Carissa on a rooftop patio at Carissa's apartment in Mexico City, and I started by asking Eddie to tell me his immigration story.
So we moved to the U.S. when I was 5. We moved there with a legal visa. We ended up overstaying there,
so you were living illegally in the United States.
We were living legally, and then we ended up living illegally for the rest of the time. I went to college there. I lived in California, so it was easier to get around that, so long as you had a tax ID number. And after university, I kind of just was aware of the limitations of my status and decided to come back to Mexico.
What were the limitations of your status?
Well, I think by going to university, you kind of train yourself to have a corporate job or so.
And you couldn't get a job like that without legal status.
Well, since then I've learned that you could, but that took way too much effort. that was not one of my specialties, trying.
So you decided to move back to Mexico?
Yeah.
Do you feel good about that decision now, looking back? Would you rather be in the United States?
I think that's way more complicated. Yes and no. I think since I grew up there and I was little, I wish I had... I have the mentality of someone that grew up in the U.S. In my mind, I should be able to go back. But I don't have the same social security as other people, so I can't go back. I'm so happy with my life now that it's give and take. And I guess I've given up something to have this.
Okay, let me go to Carissa, who has kind of the opposite story. Tell us what happened with you.
So I grew up in Colorado and Oregon and felt like I'd had amazing experiences in those places. And I wanted to try living abroad. I chose Mexico thinking that it would only be a couple of months, and if anything really went wrong, it was close enough that I could hop on a plane and be back in the States in a couple hours for a couple $100. So I came to Mexico kind of on a whim, and that was many years ago now.
And you never got the legal status that you need to be here?
When I first came down, I was kind of in and out. I was freelancing, I was popping around to different Mexican cities. So I come down for a couple months and go back, and you can have 6 months being here. And then eventually I ended up working here formally and had a working visa. And then when that ended, I reverted to a tourist visa. And as long as I come and go every 6 months, I haven't worked here again, so that hasn't been an issue. But yeah, I just have to make sure to not overstay that 6 month visa.
But there was a moment when you had to bribe an immigration official.
Yes. So there was a time very early on in my Mexico experience where I was in Oaxaca and in Oaxaca City. From there, it's pretty common for people to make border runs. They'll go down to Guatemala, and from Oaxaca City, I think it's like 12 hours on the bus. So I asked around. I didn't really want to take that bus. I wasn't sure if that was safe. Didn't want to do it. And there's a big population of foreigners in Oaxaca. All the foreigners said, you can go to the airport, you can find this guy, Jose, look for a time when there's not flights coming in, knock on the door, tell him your story, couple thousand pesos, he'll stamp your passport as if you've just arrived. So that's what I did. Sort of negotiated with him, and he said eventually, why do you want to be in Mexico? Everybody else is going to the States. And I said, but I love Mexico. And this is a common conversation. I love it here. I want to stay. And he was still kind of skeptical. Why do you want to be here? And finally, knowing a bit about Latino culture, I said, I have a Mexican boyfriend, which was not true, but he went, ah, todo por amor, and stamped my passport, and I got another 6 months.
And do you still have to leave every few months and
I
come back?
I do now, yeah.
Why not just get a work visa?
Well, I've never actually, since my previous role, I haven't worked for a company here, so there hasn't been that opportunity. I do have a lot of friends that own companies, and they've said, hey, just pay the legal fees, which will be like $400, and you can kind of fake work for our company. But it's been easy enough to leave, and I come and go often enough that it hasn't been an issue.
So what do you think about the rhetoric from President Trump about immigration, saying we've got to be tougher on immigration, we've got to tighten border security, we can't have people living in one country, especially illegally, when they are legal residents of another country?
I do believe that, like, American values, the idea of order, and I can understand the argument coming from that sense. These people, I mean, I guess I should have, but we were, that's what I don't understand, we were categorized, we were in a system. We may not have had a social security, but most, from my understanding, most immigrants do have tax ID numbers. So I know when we were in the U.S., we kept paying into a system which we had no privilege of taking out of. And that's what you do. That's how you open a bank account. Why? Because in the I mean, my experience is mostly California, which I understand tends to be more progressive in that sense, is you don't have a social security number, that's fine. What's your tax ID? And we did get audited several times. But as long as my parents were just claiming what they were making and giving it, like, the U.S. doesn't mind. Money is money. And that happens a lot. I think the whole idea of these people taking from the system, they might, but I am very aware of a lot of us who put in and never took out, and I don't understand that part of the argument.
You self-deported, by the way, long before the era of Donald Trump.
I didn't even know I did that until John Kerry was like, self-deportation. And I was like...
You mean Mitt Romney.
Oh, wait, what did I say? John Kerry, yeah. Yeah. Mitt Romney, sorry.
Carissa, what about you? What do you think of the rhetoric from Trump?
Trump's bad hombres thing really offended me. I think it offended everyone. But it... The day after the election, I was here, and that was the only time that I've had somebody yell at me about Trump. Otherwise, Mexicans would never be that impolite. So the day after the election, I went shopping in this Liverpool. It's like a department store here. And the woman who was helping me stopped midway through and said, wait, are you American? And I said, yes. And she started kind of screaming, how could you guys do this? The peso is plummeting. What's the problem? We've never tried to hurt you, blah, blah, blah. And she actually had to just walk away. And one of her associates came over and sort of apologized and helped me check out. So I feel terrible that we're picking on Mexico in particular, because most of Latin America is kind to Americans. When I go to visit places, I've never had an issue. And so for us to call an entire country, for Trump to call an entire country bad hombres, made me feel terrible as a person that travels in the world.
Now, you just used we to refer to America. So do you still consider yourself an American?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I go back to the States a lot. My family's there. I'm very much an American culturally. I'm not a Mexican.
Let me just bring it back around to what we were talking about at the beginning. Why not just do it legally? Let's start with you, Eddie.
I think if you can, do. But to pretend that the world isn't complex is to ignore reality. And life happens. So it just does. That's how we've gotten to our places. Whatever you think life is supposed to be, forget it, because that's not what it's going to be. And I think you end up pitting yourself into corners, and you have to work yourself out of it. And sometimes pragmatism is more important than legality.
Carissa?
So initially, I was coming and going and working freelance for clients in the States. So there wasn't really any incentive to pursue legal residency here. And I wasn't sure that I would stay in the first couple of years. And then I did work here legally for a couple years. And then that ended pretty recently, so I reverted to tourist status. But I haven't even been here 6 months, actually, since that ended. So after a couple years, I started to really think about being here more permanently. But it took that time to decide I wanted to stay. So now I have the opportunity to stay and pay a lawyer. And I think I also mentally converted a little bit to deciding that this is someplace I want to more permanently be. And that I do want to be legal here, honestly, just out of solidarity in a lot of ways. I want to have legal Mexican status so that I can eventually, after 5 years, you end up with semi-permanent residency. And I would like to have that because the place has a little place in my heart. Mexico has a little place in my heart that I would like to have legal representation for that.
That's Carissa, who didn't want to use her last name, an American citizen living in Mexico, and Eddie, who also didn't want to use his last name. He's a Mexican citizen who was living without documentation in the United States and self-deported to Mexico. We met on Carissa's rooftop in Mexico City. And when you look at the numbers, there are an estimated 1 million American citizens living in Mexico, and estimates are that the vast majority of them are doing so without proper documentation. This is Here and Now.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Relationships are important. Cooking together builds strong family bonds, and Blue Apron makes cooking together fun and easy. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly 3 times more often. So join in, get the family together, and choose your meals each week. They come to your door with pre-measured ingredients so you can spend time with your family and not at the grocery store. With the simple instructions, everyone can help prepare the meal. There's no risk. Get your first 3 meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/here.
And Twitter stock surged in early trading today after the social media service said it had added 9 million monthly active users in the first quarter of this year, much higher than expected. Is there possibly a Trump effect here, people signing up to follow his tweets? And the tech-heavy NASDAQ also had some good news, hitting 6,000 for the first time ever yesterday. Maybe a response to the president's proposed tax cuts. Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She joins us now from New York. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Robin.
Well, tell us more about the NASDAQ. What do you think is behind the increase?
I think part of it, you have to say, is about Trump. You know, the administration is proposing drastically reducing the corporate tax rate. There's talk about incentives, perhaps, for companies to repatriate cash from abroad back home. Tech companies would definitely benefit greatly from this, one of the sectors that would be affected. But, you know, I think part of it, Robin, is also the fact that these big tech companies, Google, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, they really dominate so much of our lives right now and commerce. And they're really pushing into the next frontier as well. What do you think? Virtual reality, artificial intelligence. So they kind of have gone from these risky bets to really being seen as the foundation of the future and the profit machine. So I think that's helping the NASDAQ as well.
Well, but what goes up comes down, as we know. The NASDAQ hit the 5,000 17 years ago in 2000. But, you know, what's happened since?
Yeah, you know, I think we're still living with the shadow of that, aren't we? You know, it was all of this promise followed by this real, if you remember that old sports, the agony of defeat, right? We had the dot-com bubble burst, the financial crisis, and investors really lost faith. And I still feel those scars to this day. We've never really, investors, especially retail investors, have never approached risk the same way again. It's sort of like a hangover that's lasted 17 years. So over this milestone, but I think the shadow is still follow us.
Well, and there were worries in Silicon Valley over the president's criticism of the H-1B visa program for foreign technical workers. Silicon Valley depends on them. But he announced only modest changes last week, so some relief there. And his immigration orders that so worried Silicon Valley, you know, the bans haven't held up in the courts. So is Silicon Valley maybe feeling a little less worried?
You know, it depends on who you talk to. I do think the DEFCON alert level has been lowered. You know, we're seeing some of the more moderate business voices of the administration, the Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, Gary Cohn, emerge more. I think there is hope in Silicon Valley that they will prevail and influence policy more. But that's not to say that the concern is gone. And I think the tariffs slapped on Canada this week highlight that. They're a little warning sign. Most people thought that that tough trade talk was just rhetoric and sort of a negotiating stance. Now that we're seeing some of those policies enacted, I think it's worrying. If you start to see that happen again with immigration, I think you're going to see Silicon Valley really sort of kick back into action.
And what about Twitter? Adding 9 million users. I mean, this is one of those classic stories. They have these users, but, you know, what about the, you know, sales and revenue?
Yeah.
But do you think Twitter does owe some of that success to the tweets from President Trump?
It's hard to say. I think Donald Trump probably would take credit for it, certainly. And I think you can't dismiss it. I mean, when it's POTUS's communication tool of choice, you got to think that that helps. But I think another thing people point to is the fact that, you know, they've been experimenting with this live programming. They had the Thursday NFL games last year. Now, they've lost that to Amazon this year, but they continue to say that they want to program this kind of live content, streaming content around the clock. So that might be helping as well.
Maggie Lake, she hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Thanks as always.
Great to be with you, Robin.
It's Here and Now. I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau at the Tech de Monterrey in Mexico City. And one of the things people are talking about here in Mexico is gasoline. This year got started with violent street protests across the country when the government lifted subsidies on gas. It was part of a broad set of reforms to open up markets to foreign investment that have been underway here since 2013. Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd went to one very busy street corner to see just how significant those changes have been.
You know, to be honest, this street is nothing special because it's packed with cars, it's packed with traffic, just like you'd expect in Mexico City, where 21 million people live in the metro area. But where I am right now is significant. There's a brand new gas station just to my left. It just opened. And in the United States, you wouldn't bat an eye if you drove by this gas station. But here in Mexico, which has closed off foreign investment in the oil and gas industry for generations, it is significant. Because on the sign that is rising above this gas station, there are two green letters. BP, British Petroleum.
It is symbolic for us, BP, because it's certainly our first.
This is BP's Alvaro Granada. I met him in a decidedly more serene setting across town, inside a skyscraper at the company's Mexican headquarters.
You could argue it has a symbolic meaning for the industry as such, because it's the first site that international oil company opens in the country.
And that wouldn't have happened without the historic reforms that led to deregulation of Mexico's oil industry.
Absolutely correct. So this new site opening is just the beginning of what for us, BP, is going to be a long-term investment process to open 1,500 sites. That's sort of what we are trying to do. And for that to happen, that the reform has been a paramount element in us making this investment decision.
Energy reform has been a long time coming. Since the 1930s, the state-owned oil company Pemex controlled every oil field in Mexico to protect its national treasure from outsiders. The monopoly began to break just a few years ago when President Enrique Peña Nieto opened the door to foreign investment. He's called it the Great Transformation, and analysts predicted it would be the most significant change to Mexico's economy in a century.
Oh, I'm very excited. Very excited because we were there 20 years too early.
Jorge Piñon is director of the Latin America and Caribbean Energy Program at the University of Texas. He also worked in Mexico for the oil company Amoco when it merged with BP 2 decades ago. Back then, he says the company was already making bets that reform would happen. They partnered with a Mexican conglomerate to open convenience stores at service stations.
They were our partners. They were legally the Mexican representative that owned the service station, and Amoco was a partner basically on the convenience side. So the idea was that over the period, again, expecting energy reform to happen sooner rather than later, we would just then change the brand, and we would already control a number of sites So we were 20 years too early, and then, as you said, energy reform came about, and here we are today.
How much of an opportunity do you see for all foreign companies from around the world to enter the Mexican fuel market now that these restrictions have been lifted?
I think it's considerable. You see already a number of major oil companies interested. BP just stepped ahead of the game. By the way, it's not only gasoline. You're talking about jet fuel at the airports. You're even talking about refineries. Mexico needs new refinery capacity. They have at least two or three refineries that need expansions, and there's a lot of people having conversations with Pemex today about investing in those refineries. And then, of course, you have the upstream and all of the deep water exploration that, as you know, is taking place now. Mm. So the whole value chain, by the way, from upstream oil and gas all the way to the retail pump is in the process of being a true open market, and that is a huge opportunity for American companies and for Mexican companies too. It is a market in transition, and it is a market that is growing. The two perfect combinations for people to get into.
I mean, Mexico is a huge country. I'm thinking like billions and billions of dollars at stake.
Yeah, the energy reform, by the way, and that is the long-term expectation of the government. That was the reasoning behind the energy reform. Was not only that, of course, crude oil production was going down, that they needed new investments and new technologies. So, yes, the investments that are going to be coming into Mexico, both upstream and downstream oil and gas, are in the billions and billions of dollars in the next 5 to 10 years.
And in that time, there will likely be growing pains as the Mexican government continues to open the energy market. In fact, they've already started. Earlier this year, protesters rioted when the government removed subsidies that had been keeping gas prices artificially low. A liter jumped as much as 20% overnight, and that was a big deal in a poor country. Near Tijuana, a protester rammed his car into a column of police. The unrest became known as gasolinazo, and the lingering distrust over gas policy hasn't gone away. Back outside that brand new BP gas station, I met Jorge Padilla. He's the business editor of Reforma, a prominent national newspaper.
Really, yes, it was a surprise to see how angry people was with the prices. And people are very sensitive about this in their pockets. They feel it very, very fast, the impact.
It doesn't take long to see what he means. A line of cars stretches as far as I can see down the busy street. Customers just waiting for gas.
Let's go to see how many patient people we have over here. It's about half an hour people make in order to fill up their gas in this BP station. So it's really surprising to see.
So we are on a really busy road in the middle on the outskirts of Mexico City. So we're going to try not to get hit here as we traverse this line of people waiting to fill up their tanks.
Here. Señor, buenas tardes.
As we walk down the line of cars, Padilla tells me that people will be worried not only about higher gas prices, but also about getting skimmed. Because Mexican gas stations have a reputation. You might pay for a liter of gas, but you don't really get a liter of gas in your tank. We peer into an open window and meet a woman named Maren Colleen.
See, it's more, it works better, basically. And it's she feels that she's paying for what she's getting what she paid for.
How long would you be willing to wait?
¿Hasta cuánto está dispuesta a esperar en la cola?
15 minutos.
15 minutes.
A little further down the line is Roberto Izaguirre. The idling Uber driver tells me in English that he's willing to wait even longer.
Because it is the exact liter, not in other gas stations. That's why.
So you don't trust the other gas stations?
For sure, yeah, I don't trust them.
So we are literally walking along as the car is moving forward in this line. We're talking about Pemex and BP and the trust that Mexicans do or do not have in these brands.
Mind that the gas stations of Pemex, they are cheating us. That's why we are here.
Jorge and I step away from the exhaust fumes and the traffic, and he tells me that these are still the early days of energy reform. But having a new brand to choose from is a very big step.
People are fed up. Basically, it's like you were forced to use for all your life just one type of gasoline, and suddenly there's another one. So you give it a chance. So that's the novelty, and people really are looking for the change.
It seems like BP knew the opportunity that it was presented.
Well, Gulf did it too, but they haven't opened it. And I think Shell, as long as I have known, they're not coming, not at this moment. But there are other players that will come. Total might come. So people, the companies are really looking for the opportunity.
But for now, the opportunity is BP's alone. It plans to open its second gas station here next month. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Mexico City.
Listeners with ophidiophobia, a fear of snakes, might want to hum through this next story. It's about Okeen, Oklahoma's 78th annual rattlesnake roundup this week. Hundreds of hunters bringing thousands of venomous snakes to town. But as Jacob McClellan from member station KGOU reports, some scientists and animal rights groups are calling for a stop.
It's a windy afternoon in the Rocky Hills of northwestern Oklahoma. And if there are any rattlesnakes here, Ty Judd knows where to find them.
Just watch where you step, because like right now, they're starting to move away from the dens.
Judd and his friends have been rattlesnake hunting these gypsum hills for years, armed with long metal tongs, a plastic bucket, and a few simple rules.
Never put your hand on a side of a hill unless you've looked it over, because little snakes will curl up there and they can bite you in the hand.
We rumble down dirt paths, stopping at dens in the craggy rocks. Judd carefully peers into each hole, plucking out the venomous snakes one by one with a tong.
When he was like sucking in there, that's like when you jump, you know, yeah, you get down and get gathered up so you can jump real high. Well, that's kind of what he's doing. He's sucking in air to get as much power as he can, so when he strikes, he's got a good enough power to get you.
David Wilson is Judd's dad. He says when the first homesteaders arrived in Okeen, Oklahoma, they had a mountain of rattlesnakes in the hills. Ranchers and farmers wanted to get rid of them, and so began a friendly competition.
They was killing them and seeing who could bring in the most. Well, then it went from who could bring in the biggest. Well, then it went from that, well, let's just see who can bring in the most and the biggest live rattlesnakes. And then it went from there.
That competition culminates in Okeen's Rattlesnake Roundup, one of five such festivals each year in Oklahoma. Pitmaster Todd Felder stands barefoot among nearly 600 rattlesnakes in the so-called Den of Death. Most are Western Diamondbacks. Felder milks the snake's venom and licks it off his hand. Rattlesnake handling is a family tradition. He learned it from watching his father and uncle before he stepped into the den the first time.
I got trained, watched them, how they do it, what they do, and then I add my own little tricks to the show and licking that rattlesnake venom off your hand. Since it is a hemotoxin, you can get away with that, but if it's a neurotoxin, you sure don't want to be taking that on.
Rattlesnake roundups are not as common as they used to be, and a study found they hurt populations of the eastern diamondback rattlesnake in the southeastern United States. Some roundups in Georgia and other states have stopped killing the animals. But wildlife diversity biologist Mark Howery with the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation doesn't think the western diamondback here is on the decline.
We're not seeing a contraction in their range. We're not seeing, you know, a strange or a differing size distribution brought into rattlesnake roundups, but we don't really know what the density of rattlesnakes is.
To some, rattlesnake roundups are inhumane because the snakes are killed as part of a show. The Center for Biological Diversity and the American Society of Ichthyologists and Herpetologists have called for an end to roundups. Cameron Seiler is the assistant curator of herpetology at the Sam Noble Museum in Norman, Oklahoma.
We would never see this behavior done on any other group of organism on the planet, definitely not in a public forum and celebrating kind of a mass killing of larger or vertebrate animals in general.
Seiler says scientists follow protocols to kill animals in research facilities to minimize pain and suffering, and that doesn't happen at Roundups. And he doesn't buy the argument that Roundups protect farmers and livestock.
I feel like the Roundups actually impose a greater risk to humans than just leaving them alone, because you're bringing hundreds of individuals of venomous snakes in close proximity to a large number of humans, which increases the risk of getting bitten.
And that's just what happened to Tony Felder, a member of pitmaster Todd Felder's rattlesnake handling family. He died back in September after a rattler bit him. Still, rattlesnake bites are nowhere close to being a leading cause of death in the United States. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says, on average, about 5 people die each year from snake bites. More die from lightning strikes and fireworks accidents. For Here and Now, I'm Jacob McClelland.
Well, a note before the break. We are saddened today by the death from cancer of director Jonathan Demme. You'll be hearing much about his terrific film, Silence of the Lambs, Stop Making Sense. But if I may, a memory of picking up the phone years ago to find Jonathan on the other end raving about the compassionate parents, Dude and Barbara Angus, in a documentary I'd made about AIDS. "I want them to come to my set," he said. Well, the film was Philadelphia, and ultimately actress Joanne Woodward would base her character, the mother of AIDS victim Tom Hanks, on Barbara Angus. Jonathan told me years later, this was how he worked.
I think that all of the films I've done are acts of collective invention. A big group of us gather together. Everybody's expert in one field or another, and maybe they're on the actor side of the camera, or maybe they're on the technical, artistic side of it. But everybody shows up and does their work.
Jonathan Demme was 73.
I was bruised and battered. I couldn't tell what I felt. I was unrecognizable to myself. I saw my reflection in a window and didn't know my own face. Oh brother, gonna leave me wasting away on the streets of Philadelphia.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson in Mexico City. We're back here tomorrow. This is Here and Now.